Since burning, all space is filled with the fragrance. All Buddha smell it from afar. Auspicious clouds gather everywhere. With utmost sincerity, all Buddhas appear. We pay homage and offer clouds of incense to the Bodhisattvas and the Mahasattvas. We pay homage and offer clouds of incense to the Bodhisattvas and the Mahasattvas. We pay homage, we offer clouds of incense to the Bodhisattvas and the Mahasattvas.
I vow to cut off all evil within me. There will be no evil that I will not cut off. I vow to practice all types of goodness. There'll be no type of goodness I will not practice. I vow to save living beings. There'll be no living beings I will not save. Gata on opening the sutra. An unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect Dharma is rarely met with even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see, to listen to remember, and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. Good morning. So we are closing out our retreat on aspiration for the end game. And, you know, so many times we think this is all something about the head, but it's not really about the head, you know. It's actually the mind of the heart, and not this one that's beating in your chest, but that which is the fabric of your very being. When I'm doing a preparation, like we did incense burning, just now, I am fully in there. The incense being the words of my lips that speak of my heart, and not just saying the words or singing the words, but that being the totality of my aspiration. And it becomes my experience. It's a very, very deep thing. So I apologize for the tears, but they come out of gratitude. I have such a deep gratitude for all that the Buddha has given to us, and all of the Buddhas that came before him, and the Buddhas that have come and will come after him. He says that in this practice, he is adopting us into the family through wisdom, through knowledge. He's pointing the way, but we actually have to walk in that way to get it for ourselves. Otherwise, we'll just read about what other people got. And so I want to close out today by talking about the importance of practices that we do that prepare us to have an aspiration for the end game. And the purpose of Buddhism, of the teachings, is to escape the wheel of samsara, you know, birth and death. And first, this does not mean that the Buddhas become extinct, because that would be nihilism. And Buddha specifically said that he did not teach that. So it doesn't mean that there is nothing, but it does indicate that there is some sort of existence that's based on having only produced good causes and no unwholesome causes, so that we have no karmic repercussions, or that we are released from the law of cause and effect, because cause and effect is what produces temporary circumstances, impermanence. You do this core rising with that as the fruit of it. You do this core rising with that as the fruit of it. You do this core rising with that as the fruit of it. So things are constantly changing according to our wholesome and unwholesome thought, speech, and action. Mm-hmm. And so there's this temporariness. And so the question was, isn't there anything that's permanent and that's lasting? That is lasting. He said, yes, there is, but not in, but we can attain it because we've been covered up for such a long time with these hindrances and taints and strapped with these fetters that keep us tethered to samsara, and its identifying factor is continual birth and death, or impermanence. And so he talks about there is that which is not that. And he begins a course of teaching us how to enter in that. So I say to you, does your current practice develop a fuller understanding of this? And do your thoughts and speech and action have this end goal in mind? Or are we only interested in immediate rewards for self-gratification and the needs and the concerns, our own needs and concerns and the needs and concerns of those that we love? That's the question. And if it's not, then we need to up our end game. And it is possible to do that. It has a far-reaching benefit. It also has a present and immediate benefit. So asking those questions, I'd like you to ponder, how do you think you can build upon this question, or clarity around this question would alter the way you live your life and the way you use your resources, showing compassion for all living beings equally with oneself. There's a practice that we do that says self and others are equal. And sitting there contemplating the equality of self and others changes in time as we continually lean and incline in that way. It changes our mind about us being superior to others, supreme to others, and that it's my job to take care of me and you take care of you. One develops a sense of union with others, and we begin to see others like we see ourselves. I know that if I make a mistake, I don't want everybody outing me. So do I have a tendency to out other people when they make a mistake? I have to ask myself that question. If I make a mistake, I don't want it to be something that somebody holds over my head forever. They only see me from that one space of time, that one incident, that one thing I said, and now I am fixed in their mind that I am this way or I am that way, and I know that I have made mistakes and I make mistakes, but I want a person to just that snapshot is not the total me. And so how do I relate to others then? When they make a mistake, do I have in my mind, oh, she's that way. Oh, he's like this. Or can I say, oh my goodness, that could have been me, could have been a mistake I made. I remember, and Tawera, you might remember, this was a long, 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 long time ago, but I had been invited to teach at one of the, I think it was the Dharma CDL at the certified, whatever CDL is, and certified, what is it?
Dharma leader.
It's okay, certified Dharma leaders.
It's community Dharma leader.
Community Dharma leaders. Okay, so I was speaking at a community Dharma leaders retreat or conference, and there were a lot of things going on. And because I'm not really a part, an integrated part of your community, I wasn't privy to a lot of things. All I know is that I came on after the Dharma leaders had already like put some other teacher off and said, like, we don't want to hear anything else that you have to say, because they had in their explanation and in their views, their words were just too damaging to the students and to the listeners, and they took exception to the expressions and maybe even the thoughts that were behind the expressions. And so when I arrived, I think it was Tanessa who was there and a couple of other teachers, and they said, oh, we're so sorry that we invited you. You know, this is not a good day, you know. And I said, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. And so I arrived just shortly before my turn. And then I went out and I began to speak. And as I spoke, I mean, I was just speaking from the heart. But in that speaking from the heart, I said a wrong thing. I said, because I'll never forget it, I said something about illegal aliens. And nobody reacted, you know. Nobody, you know, got up and started pounding on the table. And like, nobody, there was no outward reaction. You know, and I just went on with my talk, and I was truly speaking from the heart. So there was a vehicle that the words rode upon that was connecting, even though I had used a wrong term. And so somebody tacked a little note on the board, you know, and instead of railing on me, they said, sister, the next time you might want to refer to them as undocumented workers. And I got that note. And I had to give my second talk right after lunch. And after lunch, I said, I am so sorry. I said, and I appreciate you so much, you know, that you could understand what I was saying, even though I used a wrong expression, even though I used the wrong word, because that's what they were called in my time. And I'm old school. And I said, I'm so grateful that you could see past my word and you could tap into my heart space. And that's what I mean, that when the heart is right, it will make room for you. It'll make room for your mistakes. And you can receive a mistake as a mistake, and you can correct that thing. You don't have to hold to your pride. You don't have to, you know, and we have to get this way in order to make progress on this path. So the things that I'm bringing up today, and that I started with yesterday, is having an authentic practice and not just vain and empty theories, but that we should have some accomplishment in that which we say we believe, in that which we say that we understand. And it should show up in our interactions with one another. So the questions that I'm asking sound like simple questions, but they're not. And part of how well we can do this depends on how surely we understand the goal of practice. You know, if our practice doesn't go any further than, you know, what we need for ourselves and how to be happy with our things or how to be better on our job or how to even just have more personal peace and calm, then it's not enough. One has not understood the true purpose of the practice and have not understood the destination of the path. And so it doesn't mean that we don't inherit along that path all of these other things. So I will be happier maybe with my things. You know, it depends on what your things are. You know, you like some things and I like other things. It doesn't mean that we cannot be happy with them. I'm just saying that is not the goal. And we'll come to the end of our life and we will have missed the whole purpose, playing like a child with the trinkets, you know. And so I'd like to ask, does your current practice develop a fuller understanding of the true goal of getting off the wheel of samsara, even if there are things that you can't do right now, even if there are ways if there are understandings that have not come to their fullness in you? The Buddha says that we have to do this gradually, line upon line, precept upon precept, here a little, there a little, until we come to the fullness of knowledge. But the only way we get there is by continually taking a step, stretching ourselves. I'm so sorry. Excuse me one second. Kay? Can you come in? So they weren't supposed to be here until 2 o'clock to clean up the branches, and I see Bill right now at the door. Could you take care of him? You know, Bill has his own.
Let me get him.
He has his own mind, and he's taking him to the wrong place.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. We had a storm last night, and pine trees, they just crack under the storm, and brought down a lot of branches and hit my car again, and I have people coming to take care of them. So I hope you can't hear them too much. I'm sorry. So you know that all worldly dhamma is Buddha dhamma, right? You know, so that was part of this too. You just stop and do what you have to do, and then you keep on going. And so how do you think clarity would allow you to build upon this question? And how would you alter your life and use your resources showing compassion for all living beings? For example, I received an email last night from someone in the Sangha I know. And they said, before COVID, I attended your Sangha. I printed out the email. Before COVID, I attended your Sangha for 2 years regularly, and I enjoy it so much. And I'm wondering if we are open now for in-house Dharma, and is it safe for me to return? Now, Panyawati felt like saying, during these 3 years that we've been closed, did you think about supporting the center so it could remain open so that when COVID was over, we'd have a place to come back to? Like you, we still had the mortgage, utilities, you know, the food, the medical expenses, the nuns who continued to do Dharma work and serve people and teach online. How could we still be here without support from others who care about making the Dharma available, not just for their personal comfort, but for the enlightenment of the whole world? But I didn't say it. I thought it, but I didn't say it. Because what? You know, because if you have to say this, then the blindness and selfishness of the person is too deep. For such a one, you can only be grateful that you are still here to help them progress bit by bit. No. And so, you know, we don't lose all common sense. We add to common sense. You know, the Buddha helps us to expand beyond our little microscopic world, you know, and we start thinking about others and others' needs the ways that we think about our own. We start thinking about what it really takes, you know, to propagate the Dharma, or to walk it out, to live it out. We start to think about the sacrifices others make, and what is my responsibility, what sacrifice can I make? We start to think like grown-ups, is what I'm saying. And so, I'm sorry, I have tough Dharma here. You can't come here unless you just wanna hear it straight. But it does something for us. It helps us to mature. It helps us to mature and to bring our level of cultivation up to the place that we can also walk in the fruit of that level of cultivation. We say we want a deep Dharma. That's why we start at the end of the book. That's why we started with the meditation, right? We start, but he said, I teach gradually. The first thing I teach is generosity, because I know that when you go deeper, or you can only go so deep according to your expansiveness, according to the openness of your heart, according, you know, so he said, the first thing I taught was generosity. And when I could see that their generosity was at a certain level, then I taught this. And when I could see that that was at a certain level, then I taught this, and then I taught this, so that they could come along and be really useful in an authentic way, and not in a childlike way. That they could understand this Dharma, and they could be champions and charioteers and know how to war against evil with their goodness, so that their goodness could spread across this worldly realm. But we're losing the battle because we're not maturing. And so there are so many places in the suttas that we like, we just don't go there. You know, we don't go there because we don't want to be seen as not intelligent. You know, so we could take this part, and this part, but we don't want that, that, and that part. We even had the nerve to start calling some things cultural baggage, as much cultural baggage as we have. But he said, when you put these things into place, even though it may seem strange, especially in a culture where there is so much pride around rugged individualism, you know, that we're not taught to think of the whole. We're taught to the victor belong the spoils, you know? And so there's a lot in us that needs to be challenged and needs to be uprooted. While we think we're good and we're the best in the whole world and our way is the right way, and you know, and everybody thinks that way, and that's why we can't get along with each other. But when we start looking through the lens of the Dharma, then we can see our faults. That's why Dharma talks are so good. That's why they're so important, because there's something there that at the right time, at the right moment, will prick somebody's heart, will prick somebody's conscience, and suddenly the scales fall from their eyes and they can see something within themselves that needs correcting. You know, we see stuff in other people that needs correcting, but it's not as easy for us to see what's in ourselves that needs corrected. What really is the cause of our unhappiness or discontent? And so as we begin to learn Dharma, we can find that we get more and more discontent, you know, and we start moving inward in a certain way as a protection for ourselves, rather than allowing ourselves to be scorched by the fiery truth of the Dharma so that we can transform. No other way by which we can transform. No other way. And to recognize that we would not even have the opportunity to encounter it, except that we had produced the causes or for this condition to manifest. So when we think about encountering the Dharma, it's not happenstance. It is the fruit of the of our effort or some labor that has occurred in the mind stream, so that when this is heard, it resonates with us and we investigate, even if we don't remember, even if we don't know what it is, even if it's too much or it's too hard, it says that's okay. Just let it get in there and just move around. And bit by bit, it changes how we see things, how we know things, how we understand things, how we experience things. And this is the real truth. But we get sidetracked and we start, spouting Dhamma talks and or Dhamma phrases from our suttas, and we sound so witty and so knowledgeable, but it's only what we can actually put into practice that matters. And so I'm asking you to consider upping your game, because we're living in perilous times, of course, in Samsara, and in this plane, all times of perilous times because of our greed, our hatred, and our delusion. But we can lessen it the more we surrender to the truth of the Dharma and let it have its way with us. Let it have its way with us. In the incontrovertible teachings, that's sutta number 60 in the Majjhima Nikaya, the Buddha talked about nihilism. And he said, householders, there are some recluses whose doctrine and view is this. And he talks about some things, but the line that I want to read, that there is no other world. He says that there is no this world, there's no other world. And it is to be expected then that they will avoid the three wholesome states, good bodily conduct, good verbal conduct, good mental conduct. And they will undertake practices that are unwholesome. And why is that? Because they do not see the danger, the degradation, the defilement. And they do not see in the wholesome states the blessings of renunciation, the aspects of cleansing. So whenever I find myself at fault, I turn back to this sutta so that I can rejoice in the aspect of cleansing. So I'd like you to make a note of that one for today, because these are your homework assignments. You know, how can I take up cleansing? Aspect of cleansing, that doesn't even sound like Buddhism, does it? But there it is, it's right there. The aspect of cleansing, the blessing of renunciation. I'm pondering what blessing is there in renunciation, in giving this up or giving. I know what the benefit is in keeping it, but I don't have it balanced with what is the blessing in renouncing it, in giving it up, in letting it go. And just see what comes up for you around things. This is how we change. We allow the Dharma to teach us, to instruct us. This is no person doing it. That's a good point. I might not necessarily want you teaching me something, you know? So I never take the teacher as the teacher. You know, one time when the Buddha was getting ready to enter into Parinibbana, he said, well, wait, but you didn't leave us, you didn't appoint a teacher. Who's gonna be our teacher? Now that you're gone, he said, when did I ever say I was your teacher? He said it all the time, I'm your teacher. You know, this is a plain words. He said, be a lamp unto your own feet and a light unto your own path. He said, let the Dharma be your teacher. And so we're living in these times where some of us may have not had the wondrousness of encountering a Buddha on some level. Now I have, and it has done so much for me. It's helped me to penetrate beyond words on a page, you know, to touching something in someone that was a spark of life within itself, and I got burned. And the wonderfulness of getting, of experiencing that burn is that the scales do begin to fall from your eyes. That's it. Now, since there actually is another world, one who holds the view there is no other world, but this world has a wrong view. Don't take my word for this thing. Read Sutta number 60 for yourself. Has a wrong view. Since there actually is another world, one who intends there is no other world has wrong intention. Since there actually is another world, one who makes the statement there is no other world has wrong speech. Since there is actually another world, one who says there is no other world is opposed to those arhats who know the other world. And then he, of course, he always states something in the opposite way, since there actually is another world. One who holds the view there is another world has right view. Since there actually is another world, one who intends there is another world has right intention. Since there actually is another world, one who makes the statement there is another world has right speech. Since there actually is another world, one who says there is another world is not opposed to those arhats who know the other world. So it says, if there is another world, about this a wise man considers, then on the dissolution of the body after death, this good person will reappear in a happy destination, even in a heavenly world. So I talked about in the beginning some things. I asked the question, we know what things not to do, but do we know what things to do? That we add to our arsenal that carries us further on the path. So the songs that we picked out and that I picked out to share spoke to that. These are songs that we wrote based on our life, you know. And one of them said, when I'm living on the ropes, when my heart is hurt and my mind confused, I hear you calling me. Why? Because the Buddha does not exist, just not in the way that is subject to cause and effect. I said, when I'm living on the ropes, I'm going down for the third time, I can find some solace because I hear his words throughout space and time echoing. I hear him calling me. And they say, why be afraid of false surging waves? They're just impermanent states of mind. And at once I'm free of that false identity because I've heard the master call from afar. It says, there's a true unbinding, a joy to be received when stainless vision rises and we stand undeceived, embracing circumstances, our hearts can be relieved. This is the end of suffering. If you want to be saved from your self-destructive ways, listen to the master calling. This is not a dead Dharma. It is as alive as it was in the days that the Buddha walked the earth. It is as alive today as it was then. Throughout space and time, the echo of truth reverberates. You see the Dharma in this way, or is this a self-development technique to help me with my anxiety or with my stress? It can be that because it is that. But to the extent we enter into it, all it becomes so much more than that. It becomes a lens through which we can see life, that we can experience life. And so we did the liberating prayer of the praise to the Buddha. And it said, oh, blessed one, Shakyamuni Buddha. I'm like developing an attitude now, you see, an attitude towards the Dharma, an attitude towards my life, how I will walk it out. The things that I think about, not just the things I think about, the things I say, not just the things that I say, the things I do, but not just the things that I do, but what attitude is being promoted? What is motivating the words that come out of my mouth? You know, what's behind it all? And I'm thinking about the one who gave me these precious teachings. I consider him a precious treasury of compassion, a bestower of supreme inner peace, who loved all beings without exception. You know, we like to be special. I remember one time when I was, I had gone to China and I ordained by accident. You know, it was like, I don't know what happened. I got in a different environment. And, you know, I was married. I've been married 28 years, and I'm thinking, and I love my marriage and I love everything about it, except there's this burning yearning inside for something, and I don't know what it is, you know. But I get out there in this other environment where I'm away from everything. And suddenly I'm only left with that part of me that was, I didn't know it was dharmic. I thought it was Taoist at that time, because I was a Taoist priest. And Panyadeepa and I had gone out there to meet our master's man. And the thing about going out there is he has no address, and he has no phone and no email. So if you want to get in touch with him, you have to send a signal. You just mentally send a signal. You know, I'm like, wait a minute, I'm buying a ticket to go to China, and we sending a signal, you know. But my master said, oh, that would be enough. He said, we just send a signal that we're coming. He will get the signal, and he'll come down out of the mountains and meet us. I'm like, I don't know about this, you know. But I said, okay, I'm gonna go with it. So we go out there, and while we were there, we were walking down the street, and all of a sudden, here comes the grandmaster walking up the street, and my master looks at me and says, see, I told you, you know. And so, and he came down to Beijing, and he stayed for several days in the city with us, and he taught us, and then he went back to the mountains. But while he was there, He's a breatharian. I mean, his whole monastery, they're all breatharians, so they don't eat food. They drink water, and they drink herbal teas, but that's it. And he had, at that time, he had 10 orphan children, and they also were breatharians. So I decided I was going to be a breatharian. That didn't work so good for me. But, you know, just to what I noticed, and he was like, after a few days down in the city, Master began to get weak, you know, and he says, okay, so I have to tell you something. He said, when I get weak, it's because I come into the city where there's all of these, I'm immersed in all of these low-level mind streams. He says, and the mind streams beating upon me weakened me. And what he did was he would have to put an egg in a glass of water and let it sit for a while. And he would then drink the water. And he said, I need a little support when I calm down amongst these voices. You know, he says, but when I go back to the mountain where the air is clear and the voices are silenced, you know, then I can carry myself without a need for this. But he was in a certain place in his practice, you know. And I was thinking, oh, that's so good. You know, like, I'm going to be master like him. Then he looked at me and said, Buddhism is for you. I said, no. I looked at that. I'm not interested in that. I like this right here, you know. And he said, no, Buddhism is for you. And he took me to a Buddhist monastery and asked some of his Buddhist nun friends to give me ordination. So then when you get back home, you find a monastery to go into. And that's how I ended up being very unconventional way. But I'm telling this story because I witnessed something. If you haven't witnessed anything or seen anything, sometimes you don't have enough faith that something can happen. You can see how they could attain in such powerful ways when they were there with the Buddha, because he had the signs following. So it wasn't just empty talk, but there were signs following. But this is what he says. He says that this Dharma never loses its power. So if we don't have these signs following, not for the sake of signs, but just because they occur along with the progress that we make. And so what we do is we start lowering the bar, the standard, what's possible, what's available. And this becomes a course of learning that doesn't even gain the respect that our worldly knowledge gains. It becomes something even less than that. And we have to begin to inform it with our worldly knowledge. And so you can see we turned it upside down. And in this way, we will be in samsara forever. And so we have to go back. And we have to decide what kind of a disciple we are. You know? And he starts with the faith follower. In Sutta number 70 in the Majjhima Nikaya, he talks about this, the seven kinds of disciples. Starting with the faith follower and ending with the one liberated in both ways. And you can, like, you want to know what kind you are, you can just go and read it. It'll point you out. You can know. And then he tells you what you need to do to bump it up a notch, to go deeper into your conviction that will broaden your understanding and that will ultimately result in accomplishment. Let us begin to talk about accomplishment. But first, we have to put the end goal, the true end game, into place. And so, so I sing this liberating prayer all the time. It's given to us through the courtesy of Kelsang Gyatso because I love the connection that it establishes, you know. And it says, with folded hands, I turn to you, supreme unchanging friend, and request from the depths of my heart, please give me the light of your wisdom to dispel the darkness of my mind and to heal my mental continuum. Now, when I have that kind of attitude, when I turn to the Dhamma and I begin to read it, I am open, I am receptive, I am allowing it to teach me, to instruct me. And it tears down that mindset of mine when it says, oh, I don't believe that. That's not for me. That's not my way. Oh, I don't like that. Or, you know, it allows me to just be there with it. I don't have to pass a judgment. I don't have to accept it either. I could just be there with it. And in time, when we're with the Dhamma in that way, the Dhamma begins to leaven the lump. The Dhamma begins to break down the stony heart. The Dhamma begins to destroy our the views that hold us back from the very thing that we want, our freedom, our liberation. And we start to be set free from our the ways that bind us, the fetters that tether us, you know, to a low level understanding that keeps us committing the same offenses over and over, even though we wish for freedom. And so having confidence in the power of the Dhamma this way, as we get it in us, then we begin to develop confidence in ourselves. But it's not the selfing self, it's not the panyawati, but confidence in the Dhamma that's in there. Sometimes the two wage a war. There's panyawati and there's the Dhamma in there, you know. But whenever I defer to the Dhamma, even though it may not outwardly feel it's right to me, I see the fruit of that wisdom. And then this takes on a whole different feel. One knows that they're not alone, that we are immersed in a sea of wisdom. And we begin to take it up, And we're not so concerned then about what other people think. You know, because we start to bear about within ourselves the strength and the power and the clarity and the love and the deliverance that the Dhamma promises. I ask you, do you think about the Dhamma in this way? We get out of it what we get. It says, please nourish me with the same kind of goodness that you had, that I in turn can nourish all beings with an unceasing banquet of delight, finding joy in the nourishment. So whenever we get weary, we get tired, we get, you know, then we know that we have to go back and we have to refresh ourselves. It says, through your compassionate intention, your blessings and virtuous deeds, and my strong wish to rely on that, may all suffering quickly cease. I'm making an affirmation more than offering a prayer now, because I will be part of that. May all happiness and joy be fulfilled, and may the holy Dharma flourish forever. So this is a little bit different, perhaps. But we understand this kind of love. We have it for somebody, a husband, a child, a mother, a sibling, a friend. And we know that it's vital. But do we have a love for the Dharma in that way? Do we have a love for the teachers of the Dharma in that way? Do we have a love for the exemplars of the Dharma in that way? Then we put worldly things even above that which we say is most important to us. So then our Dharma is informed by our worldly view, rather than our worldview being informed by the Dharma. So it's what I hope that I leave with you today is another way of knowing the Dharma, another way of investigating, another way of entering into the flow of the Dharma, another way of becoming the living Dharma. And it's through the vessel of the heart. So your next question for your homework is, what is your purpose for walking the path? It doesn't matter if it doesn't meet up to this standard that I've been talking about the last 2 days. The fact that you're on the path is the fact you're on the path, right? And so we just keep walking. But what is the purpose? And some of us, I remember when we started our Sangha, it was all AA people. You know, they weren't coming for the Dharma. They were just looking for any other meeting where people got around and talked, you know. And so our Sangha started off, not that we were deliberately trying to establish an AA meeting. We just said Dharma and people, and you could come and people didn't know what it was. And they came and they like, hey, I like this, you know. And they started telling some other friends and some other ones came, you know, because what I was telling them is that that yes, they may have been, you know, alcoholic, but if they're not drinking anymore, then they're not now, you know. So I was, I thought in my ignorance, I thought I was starting something called like the 13th guideline or something like that. But I understand there is a 13th in the AA and it's not a good thing. And so I messed up and said, my bad. Okay. But what I tried to do is give them confidence in their ability, in their capacity, recognizing that there had been a transformation. And it's not that I'm afraid to take another drink. It's like I have no need to take one, you know, just trying to shift the attitude from, because because they actually tell you, now you become dependent on the AA meeting, you know, and when there's not one, you're running around frantic trying to find one because you've so convinced yourself that transformation is not possible. You know, it's only if it's out of sight, is it out of mind? And I said, but you can move beyond that stage. And that's how I originally started teaching the Dharma. I wasn't teaching them about getting off the wheel of samsara and all of that. But after 10 or 20 years, we should be touching it at least. You know, that's all I'm saying. We start where we are, but we don't have to stay there all the, you know, and we have to continue to develop just so that we can be a present help in the times of others' needs. that we can be present for them. You know, if I want to teach school, I don't care whether I'm teaching kindergarten or teaching the 12th grade, I still have to, you know, pass certain tests, have certain degrees. I can't just say, oh, because I know my ABCs, I can teach kindergartners because they're not even on their ABCs yet. No, I have to learn the whole curriculum. I have to go the whole distance, of course, just to teach kindergartners how to put the round ball, not in the square hole, but in the round, in the circle. You know, it's the same way with us. We have to go all the way, you know, so we should still be steadily walking so that we can be qualified to address whatever need we encounter. Don't you want to do that? Don't you want to do that? Don't you want to have somebody struggling with something in their life? That's not your thing. It's not your problem. You don't have that issue. But when they come, don't you want to have a word that you can say that can lift them out of that? And you can do it with the conviction that you know that this is true. You're not just spouting some they said. You know, this to be qualified, to have a certain attainment, to be a partaker in lifting people out of their sorrow and their confusion, out of their hurt, out of their internal burning. And that means that we have to be flexible enough to be anything at any time. If my hair is tangled, you know, I don't need a water bottle, I need a hairbrush. So when I encounter somebody who has a certain need, can I transform and become that which they need? That takes a kind of flexibility. It takes an openness to the wisdom that's blowing right now, that I can hear it, I can grasp it, and I can share it. Otherwise, they're lost. This is how we should think about the Dhamma. And this should encourage us to really search out and engage with the Dhamma in a different kind of way. Throughout, if you read Sutta number 128, I mean, just about this one book covers just about everything. It honestly does. There's a lot more books, but I love this one because I get a great sampling of the power of the Dhamma and what's available to us in like 3 or 4 pages, you know, not per subject, because it's all mixed up. I don't even know where they get these titles from, because there'll be one sentence about that title. And to me, the whole sutta is talking about other things, you know. And if we let somebody interpret for us what a sutta is about, we will only have their idea of what the sutta is about, right? We'll only have their title. But when we investigate it ourselves, it speaks directly to us. So none of it is of any private interpretation in the sense that the teacher tells you what that means. Even though we talk in these ways, you know, we're not telling you what it means. We're only sharing part of what it means to us. And you can look and see what it means to you. It could say something entirely different to you, or it touches you in a different way based on your life experience, based on where you are now, how muddled or how clear your mind is. You know, it can find you. And that's what I love about the Dhamma. It can find you. And if it can find me, then I know I'm not lost. I might feel lost, but if I turn to the Dhamma, it can find me. There you are, Panyawati. And this is where you meant to be. So you have to reroute. This is how you get over there. And that's the joy of practicing on this path. So these are questions that I had, and that's why these suttas make themselves known to me because of certain life experiences I had and questions I had. I know you have questions, and I tell you that the Dhamma will help you find those answers. So in Sutta number 128, and it's called Almost there. Imperfections. And he talks about, he's talking to Anuruddha, and when he sees Anuruddha, he doesn't start off talking about meditation. He actually starts off asking how they're getting along. And they say, oh, we get along good. He said, like, in what way? He said, we blend like milk and water. He said, exactly how do you do that? You know, he says, well, when, you know, something needs to be done and the person's doing it and one perceives it's too much for them to do, they go over and they lend a hand. It says when it's morning time, somebody goes out and goes on alms rounds and somebody else sets the plates to eat. He talks about, he says in the evening, when somebody sees that the toilet bucket needs to be emptied, he just goes and empties it. And he talked about those things like, and he said, and that's good. And he said, so I hope you then you're abiding, diligent and ardent. He said, yes, we are. And he said, and how are you abiding, diligent and ardent? He said, because we think what a boon it is to have encountered this Dhamma and these sisters and brothers in the holy life, what a great boon it is. You know, so if there's something that I want to do, and my sister or my brother in this case, in this sutta, wants to do something else, I think, why should I do what I want to do? Why not do what he wants to do? Since I'm so grateful that he's in my life, you know, that we have come together. He said, and then I do what he wants to do rather than what I want to do. And so it's this way that one learns to give oneself up, to give oneself away. If we don't have the experiences where we have to do this, then how can we just say, oh, I understand giving up, but I don't give up anything actually, you know? We have to do these things to enter into to gain the reward that comes with the experience of surrender, of giving up, of taking down. And so you can't really take down in a situation where you're not taking down, right? You have to have a situation that you're confronted with, that you have a choice of taking down or standing your ground and choosing to take down. Then one learns the release and the freedom there is, you know, in surrender. And do you want to be right, or do you want to have your friend, you know? I mean, some people would choose to just be right, but they're friendless. So we learn how to make choices based on what the end game is, what we really want to accomplish, not just what our feelings tell us we have to do in the moment to save face. So saving face is one of the first big lessons that we learn, that we can abandon saving face. I want to be right. I want to be true. I want to be sincere. You know, I want to go all out. When I say it, mean it. I mean it. And so suddenly everything you do throughout the day becomes important, not just doing things, but it becomes important. So your next one, are we on assignment number three or four, whichever one? The next one is noticing what you're doing and why you're doing it. What is your deepest intention? We'll find some things that we're doing, we could just stop doing because we're not doing them for any reason except we've always done it. Sometimes we'll think, I got another email this morning from a teacher, and she works with another Dhamma teacher. And she's also a therapist. And he has not just passive aggressive tendencies as she describes them, but outwardly aggressive tendencies. And he perpetrates them on her. But between being a therapist and being a woman who has allowed abusive men to be in her life, she doesn't know how to deal with this teacher. So we were talking about that. I said, you know, what are you responsible for your Sangha? She said, yes, we're co-teachers and we've appointed a leadership board to kind of help us because our principal teacher left and she left us in charge of the Sangha. I said, okay. I said, are there other women in your Sangha? She said, yes, they are. I said, when you can speak truth and love to this other teacher, I said, "What? How do you think that affects the other women in the Sangha that you are leading?" She said, "I didn't think about that." She said, "I only thought about how I have such a difficult time speaking to male authority in my life." I said, "Do you think you qualified to lead that Sangha?" She said, "I think I am. I know the Dhamma." I said, "But can you walk the Dhamma out?" She said, "I have to think about it." So in her email today, she said, "I thought about it." She said, "And I realized how I am not protecting the women in that Sangha when I let them, when they witness the way I allow him to deal with me." She said, "I'm going to take care of that this week." And so I'm saying, good, you know. She says, "I'm shaking in my boots."
Hey.
But yeah. Yeah, excuse me.
You gonna come out and look?
She said, but for the sake of the women, she said, because I've seen how some of them look when he talks to me in this way. And she said, I am strong enough for their sake. But in this way, they will be also helping me. So she's going to the place that scares her this week. And I just ask you all to just keep her in your mind and your heart. But she can do it. Yeah. And this is how we have to grow and develop. Even through our mistakes, people can learn something. You know, if we are vulnerable enough to do our work in their presence. That's some of the greatest work actually that we could do. Yeah, so that's my next question. So in this Sutta 128, he's asking Anuruddha all these questions. Then finally he says, Anuruddha, how's your meditation going? And Anuruddha says, well, it's going good. So the Buddha says, well, have you seen any light and vision since you've been meditating? He said, yes, I have. He said, and then what happens? He said, well, they disappear, you know, after a while. He said, well, why is that? He said, I don't know. And the Buddha said, well, you should know the reason for that, Anuruddha. When I was just an unenlightened bodhisattva, I too saw light and vision forms in my meditation. And after a while, they would disappear. But I thought, why did they disappear? And he said, and it came to me on one occasion that doubt arose in me, and because of doubt, my concentration fell away and the light and the vision of forms disappeared. He said, Anuruddha, you should discover the causes for that in your meditation. So now those who say that the Buddha says that we shouldn't have any of those things, he absolutely did not say that. You know, so you need to read it for yourself. And then he said another time he was meditating, you know, and he started descending into concentration. And then he got into a certain state, but he couldn't hold it, you know. And the Buddha said, well, why? He said, I reflected and inattention arose in me. Another time sloth and torpor arose. Another time fear arose in me. Like, and because of my fear, the concentration fell away. Another time, elation arose in me. Another time, inertia. And another time, excess of energy. Another time, deficiency of energy. And he goes on and on about all of these different things that came up in his meditation that took away his concentration. And he said that I had to do something in my practice that kept that thing from happening. So we have to look and see what is hindering us in our own meditation and what is causing us to not go on, not penetrate deeper and deeper until we get to the stages of accomplishment in the Dhamma. And he talked about there would be signs that follow. And he spoke of Moggallana as the disciple foremost in the working of the operation, the allowance of supernatural power. Yashoda, his wife, became the foremost nun or female monk. And these came about through different means, different ways. He said that one thing we can do is we can reflect on the we can reflect on the Buddha, and we can also reflect on the Devas. I had printed it out, and I'm fishing around here looking for it. On the Devas, I do want to read this particular one. Okay, I'm going to read it. It's in my email, so you'll still see me, but I'll be somewhere else looking, because this is a good one. There is a case where a disciple of the noble ones recollects the Devas, the holy beings. Thus, there are the Devas of the four great kings, the Devas of the 33, the Devas of the hours, the contented Devas, the Devas who delight in creation, the Devas who have power over the creation of others, the Devas of Brahma's retinue, and the Devas that are beyond them. Whatever conviction they were endowed with that, when falling away from this life, they rearose in those planes of existence. The same sort of conviction is present in me as well. Whatever virtue they were endowed with, that when falling away from this life, they rearose there, the same sort of virtue is present in me. Whatever learning they were endowed with, the same is present in me. Whatever generosity they were endowed with, that when falling away from this life, they arose there. That same sort of generosity is present in me. Whatever discernment they were endowed with, that when falling away from this life, they rearose in those planes of existence, that same sort of discernment is present in me. And as he is recollecting the Devas, his mind is brightened and joy arises. The defilements of the mind are abandoned, just as when a gold is cleansed through the proper technique. And how is gold cleansed through the proper technique? Through the use of a furnace, salt, earth, red chalk, a blowpipe, tongs, and the appropriate human effort. This is how gold is cleansed through the proper technique. In the same way, the defiled mind is cleansed through the proper technique. And how is the defiled mind cleansed through the proper technique? There is a case when a disciple of the noble ones recollects the holy beings. And as he is recollecting them, his mind is cleansed. Joy arises. The defilements of his mind are abandoned. And he is thus such a disciple that he lives with the Devas. It's owing to the Devas that his mind is brightened. It's owing to the Devas that his joy arises, and that whatever defilements there are in his mind are abandoned. This is how the mind is cleansed, through the proper technique. And so we did a chant today. We sang incense burning. All space is filled with its fragrance. All Buddhas smell it from afar. Auspicious clouds gather everywhere, and with utmost sincerity, all Buddhas appear. And then we pay homage and offer praises to the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas in the 10 directions. And he tells us that when we do this, what happens? He says the defiled mind is cleansed and joy arises. So if you're struggling with a mind that is not supporting your goal for walking this path, if you think you can't get certain concepts and they don't dispel the darkness of your mind, he said there are 88,000 Dharma gates by which you can enter in. That's a lot of doors. We just need to find the one that works for us and not allow anyone to tell us that there is only one. And so for me, I enter in this way through recollection and association with the holy beings in the 10 directions. And my mind is lifted up, not just in joy, but in the same power to repel darkness that they possess. And I hope you begin to use this as a means for lifting yourself, for knowing the true Dharma. The thing is that when the darkness is dispelled, we can see clearly. And then when we go back to a truth, an insight can arise. No, because we have washed the window of our mind. We have laid aside our thoughts and our ideas about something. We've even laid down what we thought we already knew to learn something else, to experience something else. So my mind works in a funny way. Going back to yesterday, I don't think I told you when I looked up the definition of rational, and then I looked up intuition. And the definition of rational was like using the intellect or the mind to know something. And when I looked up intuition, it said using direct experience to know something. Now, the Buddha constantly talked about direct experience. He said, and you can use the direct experience to bring some sanity to your thoughts so that they become rational. But we have a tendency to use our worldly wisdom to create our rationality, and then we try to make the Dharma fit into it. But my friends, I think he was taking us in a different direction. And if we have the courage to walk with him, we will see what he saw. We will know what he knew. We can undertake with power the things that he undertook, and we can become a refuge for all living beings as well. What would it be like? What would it look like? Oh, happy day. If we were walking around in the power of the Dharma that we say we represent, what capacity would manifest in this world? So I hope I have encouraged you today, and I'd like for us to go into a meditation now. And he talks about entering into the jhanas with applied and sustained thought, right? Applying thought is where you have to bring up the thought, and then your mind drifts away and you just keep bringing it back, right, to that point. Sustained thought is when you no longer drift off because you're bored with the subject, you're bored with the object of your meditation, but you can just stay there with it, abide with it. So sometimes we drop into like this kind of stillness too soon. Before we drop into it, before we have reflected, we haven't done our preparation for being there. And so when we leap into the stillness, we leap like on a low level. We can't take that broad leap, that broad jump, because we haven't created the condition to land up there. But if we do our preparation on a daily basis, you know, being mindful of that, it's more than just bare awareness that we have to be mindful of. We have to be mindful of all these things we talked about yesterday. And we talked about a lot of things yesterday. Only get to see you once a year, so I have to throw them all in at one time. But if we are mindful of these things constantly, continually, then when we take that leap into stillness, laying aside covetousness and grief for the world, we actually can lay it all down. And there we find ourselves catapulted according to our effort, according to our energy, according to our faith, according to our wisdom and our knowing. We can then abide in those sublime states here and now. And when we come out of them, we can bring back that information and we can inform our everyday life, our everyday walk. We talk about being the change that we want to see. You know, it's more even than being the change that we want to see. But we come back bearing gifts, the gifts that come, that co-arise with the wisdom that we are touching. And we bring that wisdom back into the world. We bring that compassion back into the world. We are a carrier of that love in the world. And then this life has meaning. And he said that if you didn't believe it, these things about there being other worlds, he said, you'd have a good life here. So this preparation is sweetening the mind. And you find your own words. It's your affirmations about how you want to be, what you want to be, what you declare about yourself and the lovely Dharma. You know, it's the opening of your heart to the Sangha member that you don't care too much for, or for the person in your neighborhood that you know, you just avoid them because they don't have the same ideas that you have. I remember I used to get on the elevator an apartment building I lived in. It's amazing the things that you remember out of your whole life. I'm 71 and that stays right up in the front of my mind. No, but when we get on the elevator, we say, good morning. He said, oh, it's a terrible day. This is 8 o'clock. It's a terrible day. And he started to go into, or you say like, good morning, how's your day, or something like that. And he goes into this whole diatribe of what's so bad at 8 o'clock in the morning. So it got to be to the place of when I opened the elevator door and he was on it. I said, oh, forgot something. And I turned to go back because I didn't want to start my day that way. No. But then later I thought about how I could succor some of his suffering. And I said, maybe I just step in the elevator with him, you know, and let my mind pervade the elevator. And that's what I started doing. I still say, good morning, it's a beautiful day. And he said, oh, I don't see what's so beautiful about it. But he was putting out it's not beautiful, and I'm putting out it is beautiful, you know. And then one day, all of that stopped. He just stopped saying it. He would actually look in my eyes and nod or smile, or sometimes not say anything, but the shift had started. So before you step out of your door, your bedroom door, before you greet a loved one in your home, before you see that first person on the street? Can you build yourself up so that you are brightness in their life, just in walking past you? And the last thing I'm gonna say, there was a time I was in a monastery in California, in a Chinese monastery, and Master would not let me go out. I couldn't go anywhere. I couldn't leave the compound, but other people could go out. And so sometimes I would sneak out in the back. There was a broken board on the gate, on the fence, and I would lift it and I would sneak out and I'd go to Starbucks or something. But one day when I came back, she was standing there like this, you know. She says, "I know every time you sneak out of the temple." And I said, "Well, how do you know?" She said, "Because you get in trouble and you bring that stuff back here." She said, "When you were walking down the street to the store today, you remember the man that was crippled?" And I said, "Yeah." She said, "Well, that pain and that affliction jumped right out. Off of him and jumped right on you. Now you bring it back in here and I have to release it. You're so stupid. You don't even know you have it. You don't even know you picked it up because you don't even know your own mind." You know, and that was because when I saw him in his struggle and I had sympathy for him, but I didn't know how to keep myself, my own mind. And so I brought some of that feeling back with me. You know, that all of this was like, you know, that's why I was there, to learn these kinds of things, because I didn't know how things work, you know, and so then she helped me, and so there were things like that I learned. One time I was like, "Oh, my favorite was peanut butter," and we never had peanut butter. It was a Chinese temple. We never had peanut butter. We just had noodles and noodles and noodles, and I just didn't want any more noodles. And I just said, "Oh, what I would give for a peanut butter sandwich." And I was working, you know, I was doing my chores in the temple. And she just gets up and she looks at me and she just walks right out the door. She comes back in a minute with a brown bag, takes a jar of peanut butter, slams it on the table, bam. "Now, will you get back to work?" You know, but so I say to you, don't be afraid of these powers. They come because they come to us, for us to be able to use them to help people. You know, there's nothing evil about accomplishment. There's nothing evil about attainment. It's just if we don't use it in the right way. And worse, if we don't know that it's for the sons and the daughters of the Buddha. They co-arise with the wisdom. Get the wisdom and use whatever else comes with it, is what I say to you. And so as we're sitting here preparing our hearts and minds for even just one moment of stillness, making our way to that stillness, being grateful not just for the day, but being grateful for all of the awakened beings throughout space and time. And recollecting how we are studying and embarking upon stepping on to and walking out the same things, and so we can expect to inherit the same results. An upright mind, a hearty and fearless spirit, compassionate engagement, loving being kind, that we can exert the right effort to produce the right results. We can judge our thoughts and we can put them in two categories, wholesome or unwholesome, beneficial or unbeneficial, useful or not useful. And we can override our impulses for self-preservation, electing instead to be the conservator of all. We can learn to hold our speech, to tolerate a slight, to overlook a fault, to know that we can't always win, so that we can have as much respect for losing as we do winning. It becomes easier for us to be able to yield because there's no self that we have to protect. That opens the space for more creative dialogue. We think lovely thoughts about each other. Looking for an opportunity to serve, to give, to foster confidence in another, to build respect for the other. How that lifts us up so that when there is a moment of darkness that comes, we can say, I'm able, more than able, to accomplish what concerns me today. I'm able, more than able, to handle anything that comes my way. I'm able, more than able, to be just what I really want to be, because I've thought about what I want to be and how I want to be, who I want to be, what I want to be, when I want to be it. When we're on the meditation cushion, we want to be kind to everyone. But what about when I'm in that situation, in the moment when someone's not being kind to me? What do I want to be then? And we make a vow to ourselves that when that time comes, I will carry myself nobly in this way and know that I have resident in me the Dharma that can sustain that vow. Oh, what a wonderful life to walk the Dharma. Walking in this Dharma stream, I believe in you and I believe in me. Waking up from the dream, I believe in you. I believe in me. I'm learning the way to breathe. I'm learning the way to live. I'm learning the way to love. No more sense of a solid, separate me. Bodhisattva's guiding my way, and I see things differently. Show me the way to live. Show me the way to love. Show me, lead me to. Allow the unfolding of an awakened mind. Awakened mind. Oh, awakened mind. Awakened mind. when we sweeten the mind in this way, there's a kind of deep peace and a boundless joy that is present. And when the Buddha first started to experience it, it made him afraid because he thought that the path was one of such asceticism and flagellation of the physical body and beating down of the mind. But then he realized that he need not be afraid of the joy. There was a rising that was not a pleasure of this world. He said, why should I be afraid of the pleasure that's not born of this world? And so he was not afraid. And it said that when such a one reflects in this way with the conviction that we are endowed with the same virtue, that whatever sorts of thoughts and aspirations that were present in them, the same sort are in me. He says, in that way, defilements are removed, the defiled mind is cleansed, and there is great joy. A joy that the world didn't give and the world can't take away. So I'd like to close while you're continuing to sit in the ease that comes from a regenerated mind and a pure heart. There's a Christian scripture I love that says, give me a clean heart and renew an upright spirit within me, and then I will teach transgressors the way. And if we can just close out on that song, Awaking Mind, just playing softly as we continue to sit for the next 3 minutes. And then we'll turn it over to Tawari.
feeding the illusion of a solid separate me. Bodhisattvas guiding my way, and I see things differently. Give me a way to breathe. Give me a way to love. Give me a way to live. Sitting even in the midst of the uneven, resting with the don't know mind, reflecting truth that time is short now. No more blocking out the wisdom, it's been writing all the time. Oh, wake on mine.